You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collected works by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Bhagavad Gita in the West, which consists of two separate cycles put together. I'm on the second cycle. This is numbered Lecture 13, but in the cycle inside the book, it's Lecture 8, given in Helsinki, June 4th, 1913. If we want to approach such a creation as the sublime Bhagavad Gita with full understanding, it is necessary for us to attune our souls to it, so to speak, to shift into the manner of thought and feeling that really lies at the basis of such a work. This is especially true for people who, by situation and circumstances, are as far removed from this great poem as Westerners are. It is natural for us to make a contemporary work our own without much difficulty. It is also natural that those who belong to a certain nation should always have an immediate feeling for a work that has sprung directly out of the substance of that nation, even though it might belong to a previous age. The population of the West, however, is altogether remote in sentiment and feeling from the Bhagavad Gita. If we would approach it, then, with understanding, we must prepare ourselves for the very different mood of soul, the different spirit that pervades it. Appalling misunderstandings can arise when people imagine they can approach this poem without first working on their own souls. A creation coming over to us from India, from the 9th or 10th century before the foundation of Christianity, cannot be understood as directly by Westerners as, say, the Finnish Kalevala or the Greeks' Homeric poems. If we would go into the matter further, we must once more bring together different materials that can show us the way to enter the spirit of this wonderful poem. Footnote: Steiner usually refers to the Gita as originating in the 6th century BCE. There is no historical evidence for its origin in the 9th or 10th centuries BCE. But the historic and mythic sources of the Mahabharata, in which the Bhagavad Gita originated, probably do date to these centuries. End of footnote. Here I would like, first and foremost, to draw attention to something. The summits of spiritual life have always been concealed from the wide plane of human intelligence, in a certain sense, right up to the present age. It is true that one of the characteristics of our age, which is only now dawning, and which we have somewhat described, will be that certain things hitherto kept secret, and really known to only a few, will be spread abroad into large circles. That is the reason why you are present here, because our movement is the beginning of this spreading abroad of facts that until now have remained secret from the masses. Perhaps one subconscious reason that brought you to the anthroposophical view of the world and into this spiritual movement came precisely from the feeling that certain secrets must today be poured out into all people. Until our time, however, these facts remained secret, not because they were deliberately kept so, but because it lay in the natural course of human development that they had to remain secret. It is said that the secrets of the old mysteries were protected from the profane by certain definite, strictly observed rules. Far more than by rule, these secrets were protected by a fundamental characteristic of humankind in olden times, namely, that people simply could not have understood these secrets. This fact was a much more powerful protection than any external rule could be. For certain facts, this has been especially the case during the materialistic age. What I am about to say is extreme heresy from the point of view of our time. For example, there is nothing better protected in the regions of Central Europe than Fichte's philosophy. Footnote: Johann Gottlieb Fichte, 1762-1814, whom Steiner discussed in his doctoral dissertation, 1892, published as titled Truth and Knowledge, an Introduction to Philosophy of Spiritual Activity. End of footnote. Not that it is kept secret, for his teachings are printed and are read, but they are not understood. They remain secret. In this way, much of what pertains to the general development of humanity will remain esoteric knowledge, even though it is published and revealed in broad daylight. Not only in this sense, but in a rather different one too, there is an important peculiarity of human evolution concerning the ideas we must have in order to understand the Bhagavad Gita. Everything we may call the mode of feeling, the mental habit of ancient India from which the Gita sprang, was also accessible in its full spirituality to the understanding of only a few. What one age has produced through the activity of a few remains secret in regard to its real depth, even afterward when it passes over and becomes the property of a whole people. Again, this is a peculiar trait in human evolution that is full of wisdom, though it may seem paradoxical at first. Even for the contemporaries of the Bhagavad Gita and for their followers, for the whole race to which this high point of spiritual achievement belongs, and for its posterity, its teaching remained a secret. The people who came later did not know the real depth of this spiritual current. It is true that in the following centuries there grew up a certain religious belief in its teachings, combined with great fervor of feeling, but with this there was no deepening of perception. Neither the contemporaries nor those who followed developed a truly penetrating understanding of this poem. In the intervening time, only a few have really understood it. Thus it comes about that in the judgment of posterity, what was once present as a strong and special spiritual movement is greatly distorted and falsified. As a rule, we cannot find the way to approach an understanding of a given reality by studying the judgments of the descendants of the race that produced it. So, we will find no real understanding for the spiritual tendency that in the deepest sense permeates the Bhagavad Gita in the sentiments and feelings of the people of India today. Footnote: Sri Aurobindo began to write his essays on the Gita 1 year after this lecture. Close quote. End of footnote. We will find enthusiasm, strong feeling, and fervent belief in abundance, but not a deep perception of the poem's meaning. This is especially true of the age just past, from the 14th and 15th to the 19th century. As a matter of fact, it is especially true for the people who profess that religion. There is one anecdote that, like many others, reveals a deep truth. How a great European thinker said on his deathbed, quote, "Only one person understood me, and he misunderstood me," close quote. It can also be said of this age that has just run its course that it contains some spiritual substance that represents a great height of achievement, but has widely remained unknown as to its real nature, even to its contemporaries. Here is something to which I would like to draw your attention. Some exceptionally clever people can undoubtedly be found among the present people of the East and of India. By the whole configuration of their mind and soul, however, they are already far from understanding the feelings poured out in the Bhagavad Gita. Consider how these people receive from Western civilization a way of thought that does not reach to the depths, but is merely superficial understanding. This has a double result. For one, it is easy for the people of India to develop something that may easily make them feel how far behind a superficial Western culture is in relation to what has already been given by their great poem. In effect, they still have more ways to approach the meaning of that poem than to approach the deeper contents of Western spiritual and intellectual life. Then, there are others in India who would gladly be ready to receive such spiritual substance as is contained, let us say, in the works of Soloviev, Hegel, and Fichte, to mention a few of many spiritualized thinkers. Footnote: Vladimir Soloviev, 1853-1900, Russian mystical philosopher and sophiologist. End of footnote. Many Indian thinkers would like to make these ideas their own. Footnote: Sri Aurobindo absorbed Hegelian philosophy at King's College, Cambridge, 1890 to 1892. End of footnote. I once experienced something of this kind. At the beginning of our founding of the German section in our movement, an Indian thinker sent me a dissertation, footnote, that is, the Theosophical Society, of which Steiner was the general secretary of the German branch, end of footnote. He sent it to many other Europeans besides. In this, he tried to combine what Indian philosophy offers with important European concepts, such as might be gained in real truth, so he implied, if one entered deeply into Hegel and Fichte. In spite of the man's honest effort, the whole essay was of no use whatsoever. I do not mean to sound hostile. Rather, I would praise his effort, but the fact is, what this man produced could only appear as utter dilettantism to anyone who had access to the real concepts of Fichte and Hegel. There was nothing to be done with the whole thing. Here we have a person who honestly endeavors to penetrate a later spiritual stream, altogether different from his own point of view. But he cannot get through the hindrances that time and evolution put in his way. When he attempts, nevertheless, to penetrate them, the result is untrue and impossible thoughts. I later heard a lecture by another person, one who does not know what European spiritual evolution really is, and what its depths contain. He lectured in support of the same Indian thinker. He was a European who had learned the arguments of the Indian thinker and was bringing them forward as spiritual wisdom before his followers. They too, of course, were ignorant of the fact that they were listening to something that rested on the wrong intellectual basis. For one who could look keenly into what the European produced, it was simply terrible. If you will forgive the expression, it was enough to give one the creeps. It was misunderstanding grafted onto misunderstanding. So difficult is it to comprehend all that the human soul can produce. We must make it our ideal to truly understand all the masterpieces of the human spirit. If we feel this ideal through and through, and keep in mind what I just said, we shall gain a ray of light to show us how truly difficult it is to access the Bhagavad Gita. Also, we shall realize how untold misunderstandings are possible and how harmful they can be. We in the West can well understand how the people of India look up to the old creative spirits of earlier times, whose activity flows through the Vedantic philosophy and permeates the Sankhya philosophy with its deep meaning. We can understand how Indian people look up with reverence to that climax of spiritual enlightenment that appears in Shankaracharya, 7 or 8 centuries after the foundation of Christianity. But we must think of it in another way as well if we want to attain a truly deep understanding. To do so, we must set up a kind of hypothesis, for it has not yet been realized in evolution. Let us imagine that those who are the creators of the sublime spirituality that permeates the Vedas, the Vedantic literature, and the philosophy of Shankaracharya were to appear again in our time with the same spiritual faculty, the same keenness of perception they had when they were in the world in that ancient epoch. They would have come in touch with spiritual creations like those of Soloviev, Hegel, and Fichte. What would they have said? We are assuming that what the adherents of those ancient philosophies say does not concern us, but only what those spirits themselves would say. I am aware that I am going to say something paradoxical, but we must think of what Schopenhauer once said, quote, "There is no getting away from it. It is the sad fate of truth that it must always become paradoxical in the world. Truth is unable to sit on the throne of error. Therefore it sits on the throne of time and appeals to the guardian angel of time. So great, however, is the spread of that angel's mighty wings that the individual dies within a single beat." Close quote. Footnote: Arthur Schopenhauer, 1788 to 1860, German philosopher of pessimism and the will, and one of the earliest European interpreters of Hindu and Buddhist scriptures. End of footnote. So we must not shrink from the fact that truth must appear paradoxical. The following does also, and is true. If the poets of the Vedas, the founders of the Sankhya philosophy, even Shankaracharya himself, had returned in the 19th century and seen the works of Soloviev, Hegel, and Fichte, all those great men would have said, quote, "These three men have achieved by the very quality and tenor of their minds what we were striving for back in that era, what we hoped our gift of spiritual vision would reveal to us. We thought we must rise to heights of clairvoyant vision. Then, in these heights, there would appear before us what permeates the souls of these 19th-century men quite naturally, almost as a matter of course." Close quote. This sounds paradoxical to those Western people who, with childlike lack of consciousness, look to the people of the East, comparing themselves with them, all the while misunderstanding what the West actually contains, a peculiarly strange picture. We imagine those founders of Indian philosophy looking up fervently to Fichte and other Western thinkers. And along with them we see a number of people today who do not value the spiritual substance of Europe, but grovel in the dust before Shankaracharya and those before him, while they themselves are unconcerned with the achievements of such thinkers as Hegel, Fichte, and Soloviev. We do so because only by such an hypothesis can we understand all the facts history presents to us. We shall understand this if we imagine those times from which the spiritual substance of the Bhagavad Gita flowed. Let us imagine human beings of that period somewhat as follows. What appears to a person today in varied ways in dream consciousness, the pictorial imagination of dream life, was, in that ancient time, the normal content of the soul, everyday consciousness. It was a dreamlike pictorial consciousness, by no means the same as in the old moon epoch, but much more evolved. This was the condition out of which human souls were passing on in the descending line of evolution. Still, earlier was what we call sleep consciousness, a state wholly closed to us today, from which a kind of dreamlike inspiration came to human beings. It was the state closed to us today during our sleep. As dream consciousness is for us, so was this sleep consciousness for that ancient humanity. It found its way into normal picture consciousness, much as dream consciousness does for us, but more rarely. In yet another respect, it was somewhat different in those times. Our current dream consciousness generally brings up recollections of ordinary life. Then, when sleep consciousness could still penetrate the higher worlds, it allowed people to recollect those spiritual worlds. Then gradually this consciousness descended lower and lower. Anyone who at that time was striving as we do today in our esoteric education aimed for something quite different. When we today go through our esoteric development, we are aware that we have gone downhill to our everyday consciousness and are now striving upward. Those seekers who were also striving upward from their everyday dream consciousness. Let me read that again. Those seekers were also striving upward from their everyday dream consciousness. What was it then that they attained? With all their pains, it was something altogether different from what we are trying to attain. If someone had offered those people my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds, they would have had no use for it at all. Its contents would have been foolishness. For that ancient time, it only makes sense for humankind today. Then, everything they did with their yoga and Sankhya was a striving toward a height that we have reached in the most profound works of our time, in those of the three European thinkers I have mentioned. They were striving to grasp the world in ideas and concepts. Therefore, one who really penetrates the matter finds no difference, apart from differences of time, mood, form, and quality of feeling, between our three thinkers and the Vedantic philosophy. At that time, the Vedantic philosophy was that to which men were striving upward. Today it has come down and is accessible to everyday consciousness. If we wish to describe the condition of our souls in this connection, we may start out by saying that sleep consciousness is closed for us, but for the ancient people of India it was still permeated by the light of spiritual vision. What we are now striving for lay hidden in the depths of the future for them. I mean what we call imaginative knowledge, fully conscious picture consciousness, permeated by the sense of the ego. I mean fully conscious imagination, as it is described in How to Know Higher Worlds. So much for the technical point that should be inserted here. In these abstract technicalities lies something far more important, that if a person today were to make vigorous use of the forces present in the soul, what the people of the Bhagavad Gita era strove for with all their might lies right at hand. It really does, even if only for a Soloviev, a Fichte, or a Hegel. One more thing. What today can be found right at hand was in ancient times attained by applying all the keen vision of Sankhya and the deep penetration of yoga. It was attained with effort and pain, a sublime effort to lift the mind. Now imagine how different life is for a person who lives at the top of a mountain and is continually enjoying the magnificent view, compared with a person who has never once seen the view, but has to toil upward with trouble and pain from the valley. If you have the view every day, you get accustomed to it. It is not in the concepts, in their content, that the achievements of Shankaracharya, of the Vedic poets, and of their successors are different from those of Hegel and Fichte. The difference lies in the fact that Shankaracharya's predecessors were striving upward from the valley to the summit. It was their keenness of mind in Sankhya philosophy, their deepening of soul in yoga, that led them there. It was in this work, this overcoming of the soul, that the experience lay. It is the experience, not the content of thought, that is important here. This is the immensely significant thing, something from which we may, in a certain sense, derive comfort, because Europeans do not value what they can find right at hand. Europeans prefer the form in which it meets them in Vedantic and Sankhya philosophies, because there, without knowing it, they value the great efforts that achieved it. That is the personal side of the matter. It makes a difference whether you find a certain content of thought here or there, or whether you attain it by the severe effort of the soul. It is the soul's work that gives a thing its life. We must take this into account. What was once attained alone by Shankaracharya and by the deep training of yoga can be found today right at hand, even if only by people like those we have named. This is not a matter for abstract commentaries. We only need the power to transplant ourselves into the living feelings of that time. We then begin to understand that the external expressions themselves, the outer forms of the ideas, were experienced quite differently from the way we can experience them. We must study those forms of expression that belong to the feeling, the mood, the mental habit of a human soul in the time of the Gita, who might have lived through what that great poem contains. We must study the Gita not in an external philological sense, not in order to provide academic commentaries, but to show how different its whole configuration of feeling and idea is from what we have now. Regarding the conceptual explanations of the world, which today, to use a graphic term, lie below but used to lie above, though the content of thought is the same, the form of expression is different. Whoever would stop with the abstract contents of these thoughts may find them easy to understand. But working one's way through to the real living experience will not be easy. It will cost great pains to go this way again and feel with the ancient Indians, because it was in this fashion that concepts first arose, such as flowed into the words sattva, rajas, tamas. Footnote: the three gunas, respectively truth or light, energy, and darkness or lethargy. End of footnote. I'll read the words again: sattva, rajas, tamas. I do not attach any importance to the ideal concepts these words imply in the Bhagavad Gita, but indeed we are inclined today to take them much too easily, thinking we understand them. We may add something further. We shall never reach an understanding beyond the limits of abstract concepts if we consider only the concepts of science regarding the activity of living beings. Sleep, for example, is not the same for humans and animals. Simply to define sleep would be like defining a knife as the same thing whether used for shaving or cutting meat. If we would keep an open mind and approach the concepts of tamas, rajas, and sattva once more from a different aspect, we can add something else taken from our present-day life. Let us consider the way humans experience nature when they enter intellectually the three kingdoms that surround them. The mode and quality of knowledge is different in each case. I am not trying to make you understand sattva, rajas, and tamas exhaustively. I only want to help you come a little nearer to an idea of their meaning. When humans today approach the mineral kingdom, they feel they can penetrate it and its laws with their thinking, that they can, in a certain sense, live together with it. This kind of understanding at the time of the Gita would have been called a sattva understanding of the mineral kingdom. In the plant kingdom, we always encounter an obstacle, namely, that with our present intelligence we cannot penetrate life. The ideal now is to investigate and analyze nature from a physical-chemical standpoint, and to comprehend it in this manner. In fact, some scientists spin their threads of thought so far as to imagine they have come nearer to the idea of life by producing external forms that imitate as closely as possible the appearance of the generative process. This is idle fantasy. In our pursuit of knowledge, we do not penetrate the plant kingdom as far as we do the mineral. All we can do is observe plant life. What we can only observe but not penetrate with intellectual understanding is rajas understanding. When we come to the animal kingdom, its form of consciousness escapes our everyday intelligence far more than the life of plants. We do not perceive what the animal actually lives and experiences. What we can understand about the animal kingdom with today's science is a tamas understanding. What is it that actually lies in these words? Without a living sympathy for what was felt in them, we cannot follow a single line of the poem with the right quality of feeling, particularly in its later sections. At a higher stage, our inability to feel our way into these concepts is something like trying to read a book in a language we don't understand. For such a person, there would be no question of seeking out the meaning of concepts in commentaries. One would just set to work to learn the language. So here, it is not a matter of interpreting and commenting on the words sattva, rajas, tamas in an academic way. In them lies the feeling of the whole period of the Gita, something of immense significance, because it led humans to an understanding of the world and its phenomena. If we would describe the way they were led, we must first free ourselves from many ideas that cannot be found in the writings of Soloviev, Hegel, and Fichte, yet lie in the widespread, fossilized thinking of the West. By sattva, rajas, tamas is meant a certain kind of finding one's way into the different conditions of universal life in its varied kingdoms. It would be abstract and wrong to interpret these words simply on the basis of the ancient Indian quality of thought and feeling. It is easier to take them in the true sense of the life of that time, but to interpret them as much as possible through our own life. It is better to choose the external contour and coloring of these conceptions freely out of our own experience. Human beings today feed themselves with various substances, animal, plant, and mineral. These foods, of course, have different effects on their constitution. When they eat plants, they permeate themselves with sattva conditions. When they try to understand them, they are, for them, a rajas condition. Nourishment from the assimilation of mineral substance, salts, and the like, represents a rajas condition. That brought about by eating meat represents tamas. Notice that we cannot keep the same order of sequence as if we were starting from an abstract definition. We have to keep our concepts fluid. I have not told you this to inspire horror in those who feel bound to eating meat. In a moment I shall mention another matter where the connection is again different. Let us imagine that a man is trying to assimilate the outer world, not through ordinary science, but by that kind of clairvoyance that is legitimate for our age. Suppose that he now brings the facts and phenomena of the surrounding world into his clairvoyant consciousness. All this will call forth a certain condition in him, just as, for ordinary understanding, the three kingdoms of nature call forth sattva, rajas, and tamas conditions. In effect, what can enter the purest form of clairvoyant perception, corresponding to purified clairvoyance, calls forth tamas. Parenthesis, I use the word purified, although not in the moral sense. Close parenthesis. A man who would truly see spiritual facts, objectively, with the kind of clairvoyance we can attain today, must by this activity bring about in himself the tamas condition. Then, when he returns into the ordinary world, where he immediately forgets his clairvoyant knowledge, he feels that with his ordinary approach he enters a new condition, a new relation to knowledge, namely the sattva condition. Thus, in our present age, everyday knowledge is the sattva condition. In the intermediate stage of belief building on authority, we are in the rajas condition. Knowledge in the higher worlds brings about tamas in the human soul. Knowledge in our everyday environment is the condition of sattva, while faith, religious belief, resting on authority, brings about the condition of rajas. So you see, those whose constitution compels them to eat meat need not be horrified at the fact that meat puts them in a tamas condition, but the same condition is brought about by purified clairvoyance. It is that condition of an external thing when by some natural process it is most detached from the spiritual. If we call the spirit, in quotes, light, then the tamas condition is devoid of light. It is darkness. So long as our organism is permeated by the spirit in the normal way, we are in the sattva condition, that of our ordinary perception of the external world. When we are asleep, we are in tamas. We have to bring about this condition in sleep in order that our spirit may leave our body and enter the higher spirituality around us. If we would reach the higher worlds, and the evangelist already tells us what humanity's darkness is, our human nature must be in the condition of tamas. Footnote, John, the author of the fourth gospel and three letters, was an important object of Steiner's esoteric research. End of footnote. Since humanity is in the condition of sattva, not of tamas, which is darkness, the words of the evangelist, quote, "The light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehendeth it not," close quote, can be rendered somewhat as follows. Quote, "The higher light penetrated as far as humanity, but they were filled by a natural sattva that they would not give up." Close quote. Thus the higher light couldn't find entrance because it can only shine in darkness. if we seek knowledge of such living concepts as sattva, rajas, and tamas, we must get accustomed to not taking them in an absolute sense. They are always, one might say, turning this way and that. For a right concept of the world, there is no absolute higher or lower, only a relative sense. A European professor took objection to this. He translated sattva as goodness, and objected to another man who translated it as light, though he translated tamas as darkness. Such things truly express the source of all misunderstanding. When humanity is in the condition of tamas, whether by sleep or clairvoyant perception, to take only these two cases, then, in effect, it is in darkness as far as the external human is concerned. So ancient Indian thought was right, yet it could not use a word like light in place of the word sattva. Tamas may always be translated darkness, but for the external world, the sattva condition could not always be interpreted simply as light. Suppose we are describing light. It is entirely correct to call the light colors red. It is entirely correct to call the light colors. Red, orange, and yellow, according to Sankhya philosophy, are the sattva colors. Under the same concept, we must also place, for example, goodness, kindness, and loving human behavior. It is true that light falls under the concept of sattva, but this concept is broader. Light is not really identical with it. Therefore, it is wrong to translate sattva as light, though it is quite possible to translate tamas as darkness. Nor is it correct, however, to say that light does not convey the idea of sattva. The criticism that the professor made of a man who may have been well aware of this is also not quite justified, for the simple reason that if someone said, quote, "Here is a lion," close quote, nobody would attempt to correct him by saying, "No, here is a beast of prey," close quote. Both are correct. This comparison hits the nail right on the head. As regards external appearance, it is correct to associate sattva with what is full of light, but it is wrong to say sattva is only of light. It is a more general concept than light, just as beast of prey is more general than lion. The same cannot be said of darkness, for the reason that in tamas, things that are different and specific in rajas and sattva merge into something more general. After all, a lamb and a lion are two very different creatures. If I wanted to describe them as to their sattva characters, the form that the natural element of life and force and spirit takes in lambs and lions, I would describe them very differently. But if I wish to describe them in the tamas condition, the differences do not come into consideration, because in the tamas condition the lamb or lion is simply lying lazily on the ground. In the sattva condition lambs and lions are very different, but on a cosmic level the indolence of both is, after all, one and the same. Our power of truly looking into such concepts must therefore adapt to great differentiation. As a matter of fact, the three concepts with the qualities of feeling in them are among the most illuminating components in the whole of Sankhya. In all that Krishna puts before Arjuna, when he presents himself as the founder of the age of self-consciousness, he has to speak in words altogether permeated by those shades of feeling derived from the concepts sattva, rajas, and tamas. About these three concepts, and what at length leads to a climax in the Bhagavad Gita, we shall speak more fully in the last lecture of this course. This is the end of lecture 13, which in this cycle, The Occult Significance of the Bhagavad Gita, the second part of this book, is lecture 8.